In a sense, this is the beginning of a research journey for me. Rather than an exposition of the results of some kind of completed research project. However, I wish this evening to plot some kind of timeline. We go this way and that, we go overseas for a little while, we come back into South Dunedin, we go into quite the deep 19th century history of both the southern area of Dunedin and Dunedin generally. We discuss, for example, how St. Peter's Church was very much part of a much greater movement of community arts expression from the 19th century to the present. And I hope somewhere along the line to unpack the remarkable transitions, the upheavals, the disappointments, and minor triumphs of the arts at St. Peter's, and mark where there is little or no information about events and activities. I need at the outset to note the generally sketchy nature of parish histories in this place, earnest though they are, and the yet-to-be-fully-explored archived material held at the Hocken Library. I hope over the next year or so to explore the St. Peter's archive there and see if it can be integrated into a wider South Dunedin perspective regarding the contribution of the various denominations to community arts throughout the 20th century. Oh, what an entrance.
So sorry, but not really.
It's still going if you want to go around the block again. Well, I'm merely introducing my methodology. You would have been asleep by now anyway.
Thank you so much.
The somewhat ad hoc nature of the histories of St. Peter's Caversham could well be due to the fact that the origins of St. Peter's were founded at meetings held at the Edinburgh Castle Hotel on January the 4th, 1864. Not in an upstairs room, but in the private bar. The grand sum of £294.04 were available for a church building on an acre of land on South Road, provided by a Mr. H. Clapcock. The original terms of Clapcott's deed of gift are of rather great interest, I think, great interest. It states, a site for a church and parsonage for the congregation of the United Episcopalian Church of England and Ireland, and for no other purposes whatsoever. In good Anglican tradition, after some considerable negotiation with Mr. Clapcott, a modest wooden structure was built and consecrated that year. It is of note that the newly formed St. Peter's Choir, in four parts, sang at the service. As the Caversham area grew rapidly, a new site was required and a new church built. The present site was acquired and a sturdy brick edifice constructed for £1,825 to a design by H.F. Hardy. Nothing went right. The foundation stone was laid with Bishop Neville in attendance, and despite the building sinking into the soft soil up to 6 foot, and a considerable and prolonged squabble in the courts about the compensation for the remedial work undertaken under the direction of Mr. Peter, the church was dedicated on Michaelmas 1882. It is perhaps the 19-year tenure of Canon Brian King, 1892 to 1911, where one can locate the origins of extraordinary artistic expression. King's father, an Anglo-Catholic pioneer priest in the East End of London, had been the victim of some of the most infamous London anti-ritualist riots. But nevertheless, the king, the son, after ordination, came out to Australia, where he worked with convicts in Sydney and in Melbourne, and then on to South Dunedin. Some would say not a great transition in those days. However, I move on. He brought with him that tradition of worship that he'd known in London, and also an extremely strong social conscience. In his own words, St. Peter's would welcome all whom God sent. During Father King's time at St. Peter's, a strong choral and liturgical tradition was established and developed. A considerable number of entertainments and review-style productions are of note during this time, often in connection with fundraising for church building debt. Not only the debt on the building, but also an extraordinarily strong and powerful women's group emerged at St. Peter's from its earliest days. And they ensured that the stipend was paid to the vicar. When the parish couldn't pay, they would ask what the cost owing was, if it was £50 or whatever. They would ensure it was raised, inevitably through shows, plays, reviews, concerts, and so on. This artistic life was greatly extended during the 6 years that Father J.L. Mortimer spent in the parish. A man with a strong sense of social justice, he initiated a number of community activities, including community singing, choirs singing beyond the walls of the church at various civic occasions, and drawing in a large cohort of young people who in turn performed in many concerts popular throughout South Dunedin. The sophistication of music making at St. Peter's was not only found in the secular shows, concerts and reviews, but also in the fine choral tradition of the church. Already noted as a place of excellent liturgy and music, Father Evans, during his time here, developed this even further with the introduction of quite complicated settings of the liturgy and extensive use of plain song, something not found all that often in a suburban Anglican church at that time. However, not everything musical could be termed serious. And this is one of many stories around the parish about parish animals invading services. During the 1920s, a goat was used to keep the extensive church grounds in order. On one occasion, during the conclusion of a complex anthem at Evensong, the goat appeared, strolled down the central aisle of the church, making its own vocal contribution to proceedings. The moment the vicar ascended to the pulpit to deliver the sermon, the goat ran bleating from the church to the barely disguised mirth of the congregation. The vicar's response was not recorded. The 40-year tenure at St. Peter's of Miss Bessie Favell is an extraordinary story. She was clearly a highly trained musician, both performer and teacher. She spent 2 years in London studying advanced performance and theory before returning to her post at the St. Peter's organ. While her musical gifts were in no doubt, any locatable sense of humour was seldom, if ever, in evidence. However, she inspired several generations of musicians to perform well beyond their capabilities, and the concerts of St. Peter's drew large crowds from beyond South Dunedin. At her death in 1941, those she taught continued the long musical tradition. One of her legacies was that St. Peter's welcomed concert participants from all around South Dunedin, including many of her students. The resulting church choir was, particularly during the 1930s Depression years, made up of around 40 members, 9 men, 17 boys and 14 women, termed in those days auxiliary singers, obviously pre-feminist days, many from outside also the Anglican tradition. Much of that tradition of artistic expression continues to the present day, despite the tumultuous social, religious, and economic changes affecting our community. No longer is South Dunedin the working class industrial powerhouse of the city and Otago. With it has gone those tribal affiliations of strong community and denominational groupings. It has been many years since Protestant boys threw stones at Catholic boys in David Street and vice versa. It is at this point that I would like to pinpoint some specific individuals and activities and discuss them. They range from the origins, I believe, of all the activities St. Peter's engaged in over the first half of the 20th century to such an extraordinary extent to the local manifestations of international trends at a more modest, local, and even domestic level. They follow a rough chronological order, but they rely so heavily on anecdotal evidence that any detail comes with the proviso that further research is required. And it is this area that I am now looking to research at length. The Victorians developed a strong sense of community music making throughout the 19th century. Not only was this seen to be to the moral betterment of those taking part, but fitted well into the prevailing ethos of family, community, and country, a kind of patriotic glue. But the Victorians were actually building on a long-standing tradition of church musicians who played instruments to accompany the singers in the West Gallery. In the Georgian period and into the early Victorian era, metrical psalms and sacred songs were sung in this manner. But not as no recording exists, it's hard to judge what it would have been like. City churches may have had pipe organs, and some even had choirs. But the instruments used at parish level must have been truly deafening. Wind instruments with names such as Bass Serpent and Ophir Clyde do not suggest a subtle approach or performance. However, the same instrumentalists and singers also provided music at civic occasions and in the growing number of musical theatres and music halls. Again, no doubt, with enthusiastic renderings rather than the performance of the music of the day. There are attempts to reconstruct that tradition today with various results. I was going to play a clip of this West Gallery music group formed over a weekend in the UK. There are now many of these attempting to replicate the sound of the early Victorian West Gallery choirs and musicians. But it was so awful, I decided not to. However, by the mid-19th century, things had changed dramatically. The great brass band tradition of the North, the choral singing in Wales, the vast network of choral societies throughout Great Britain and associated parish traditions were reflected in a huge expansion in popular theatrical expression. From melodrama to opera, to music hall. It hid a dearth of more serious artistic expression in terms of opera and ballet. But at the same time, theatre was very popular, and touring companies complemented local groups in the presentation of everything from Shakespeare to Oscar Wilde and the young, daring George Bernard Shaw. Few, if any, communities, large or small, would not have been able to boast at least a choral society, light operatic group, or a little theatre. But it was based, in a sense, our view of the Victorian music-making scene in terms of church is really a fantasy. The rise of the aerobed parish choir attempting to replicate cathedral worship was a notable feature of Victorian life. Many fine choirs did develop throughout the English-speaking world at this time. However, not all lived up to the confection of this image. It's one of the very few times I've dipped into a photograph from the television programme The Vicar of Dibley. The reality at local level was often somewhat more modest. Yet this was the model translated to New Zealand and many parts of the empire, but not at St. Peter's Cabbage. As you can see already, a very large group of singers under the stern and watchful eye of the vicar, and I think this even predates Miss Favell, but not by much. Very much involved with singing the two services a Sunday, but also these young people would also have taken part in the reviews and in the shows in the hall. Perhaps it was the influence of the Fabians, that group of Christian socialists who, for all their manifest failings, began to see that this artistic expression ought to be institutionalised and developed further to include all within the community. Community music festivals sprang up throughout Great Britain. Many famous musicians took part in the leadership of this celebration of amateur artistic expression. None more so than Ralph Vaughan Williams. The great composer was, oh, by the way, I had to get one with the captain. Unfortunately, what also happened, I mentioned to people before I began that there's a wonderful clip on YouTube of Vaughan Williams conducting the St. Matthew Passion, a rehearsal. And he was very deaf by then, and he had a very large hearing aid with the wire down to a large battery-operated apparatus in his pocket, and he got caught up. So he just pulls the hearing aid out and continues, probably hearing the choir far better than he'd ever heard them before. And then evidently, one of his cats chewed through the wire just before the premiere of the Fourth Symphony, which explains why he thought it was wonderful and nobody else did. However, the point is here, the great composer was as happy to conduct at the Queen's Hall as he was at the Leith Hill Music Festival in country England. He was in charge of the festival from 1905 until 1953. Amateur singers and players came from all around England to sing and play under his baton. There may well have been auditions, but that is rather doubtful. What is important was the performance of great music such as J.S. Bach's St. Matthew Passion and many of Vaughan Williams' own compositions. He was able to inspire his choir of mechanics, gardeners, milkmen, teachers, carpenters and shopkeepers to reproduce fine performances over many decades. He lived in the area and saw no conflict between music making in a drafty Dorking assembly hall, centre of the festival, and the concert halls of London. He saw this form of musical expression as vitally important. It was said of his conducting of the St. Matthew Passion at the festival, his endeavours to get a collection of gardeners, grooms, parlour maids, and the odd carpenter to sound like a howling mob outside Pilate's palace led him to remove his jacket, revealing large holes in the elbows of his cardigan. In spite of everything, the look on his face and the magnetism of his personality seemed to succeed in doing the utterly impossible, namely, getting them to sing in tune and at the same time. That artistic expression was replicated worldwide, and by the 1920s was particularly noticeable in the United States, with an explosion of choral societies and orchestras, many of whom flourish today. It also became part of the phenomenon of massed community singing. Vast groups came together at particular places to sing together. While it was thought morally beneficial, these events were hugely popular. In Dunedin, for example, the town hall could still be filled in the late 1940s for such outpourings of song. Here's one example, the Melbourne Town Hall in the 1920s. And if you were lucky enough, you got one of these certificates. And this was from Bobby Bluegum, the Sunshine Soldier. This card certifies that you are accepted with pleasure into the big army that promises at all times to spread sunshine. This was very much part of community DNA through the first few decades of the 20th century. But it was even greater in the United States, where it was quite normal to have 400,000 people arrive to sing communally. Something rather special going on here, very much encouraged by city authorities. Great enthusiasm for contesting musical excellence amongst the participants, young and old. It crossed all classes, all political borders. This movement crossed over in the late 1950s to the burgeoning of musical societies that presented shows and revues. While this diminished the role of local productions, such as those at St. Peter's, they nevertheless relied heavily on local talent to produce the music, acting, and technical craft necessary. But how did this international movement come to New Zealand? And how does St. Peter's figure in it all? Well, it actually figures rather prominently. A highly talented... Oops, one second. You've got a preview of what's to come. There we are. Remarkable man. And I've been told by one of his relatives, it's Lily, not Lily. He used to bribe about Lily. He said, I am not a Lily. A highly talented organist and choir master of St. Peter's, Alfred Lily, was associated with the church for a number of years. Born in England, he had been trained in London as a conductor, singer, and keyboard performer, all things he did with extraordinary accomplishment. During his time in South Dunedin, he created choral groups and small orchestras to provide or perform oratorios, operettas, and patriotic revues. At St. Peter's, he introduced choral music from the Tudor period into services, almost unheard of in the late 19th century in cathedrals, let alone in a small parish church. He later went on to Dunedin's Society Church of the time, St. Matthew's in Stafford Street, where he developed a distinguished musical tradition and took part in citywide music making. And it was on his foundations that the performance side of the artistic life of St. Peter's flourished. Two great influences on Dunedin community music making were Victor Galway and Vernon Griffiths. Galway was born in England, educated in Australia, and came to New Zealand in 1919 to take up the position of organist and choirmaster of First Church, Dunedin. He remained in that position until 1939, when he moved to St. Paul's Cathedral. He was appointed city organist in 1930, and he performed to huge audiences of some thousands on a regular, often weekly basis. He included quite deliberately other Dunedin musicians in his concerts and happily invited community groups to sing and perform on the big stage. In 1924, Galway began giving lectures on music under the auspices of the University of Otago. These were very popular and led actually to the establishment of the music department at the university. He worked tirelessly for the improvement of community music making, having brought much of the movement's ethos with him from England. He encouraged small community groups to expand their repertoire and helped in marking up the scores for choirs, musical groups, and reviews of all shapes and abilities. He was instrumental in, for instance, providing orchestral players for a number of early productions at St. Peter's. Thomas Vernon Griffiths was also born in England and came to Dunedin as music master of King Edward Technical College in 1933. He was a Christian socialist, appalled at the poverty he had seen in England and in New Zealand. He initiated many musical programs for working class children and adults. He formed the first of the now famous Saturday morning music groups still flourishing in the city. Through the workers' education schemes of the 1930s and 40s, Griffiths developed patterns of community music making throughout Dunedin and later Christchurch. He was a regular participant in music making in South Dunedin, though as a Roman Catholic, more at the Basilica than St. Peter's. But he assisted Bessie Favell in locating musical scores at a time when they were costly and hard to obtain. These two men worked tirelessly together to improve music in Dunedin at a civic level, and also happily developed community music making in much the same way as the renowned Vaughan Williams at the Liverpool Festival. So out of all of this activity, what emerged and flowered at St. Peter's? Well, this is where we enter the realms of anecdote and speculation, and the area I really want to investigate. There is a trickle-down effect to these major movements in the UK and sort of at the Vernon Griffiths level. Here you have the St. Peter's choir a long time ago, but also you have the same kind of format introduced into Chennai in India, singing the same music in the same kind of way, very much a part of the fabric of a wider community. And if you're wondering, I'm sure that's Gene Allen.
It is.
Yes. She's getting the right side, I think. And Father Pyle. Which is probably the reason for a pretty good turnout of the choir. Actually, at this stage, the choir was considerably larger than this. This is 1952. And the women had become choir women by then, not auxiliary singers. This is from our the music page on our website. And I think it brings into quite sharp focus what was going on in the church as opposed to in the hall. The choirs here, clearly, just one look through the music cupboard at St. Peter's, and you will see there's a phenomenal amount of music being sung, far more sophisticated than you'd expect from a small parish church. And particularly, the big anthems and evensong were always a feature of music at St. Peter's. He dealt with him. There is a... I had a photograph of Miss Favell walking through the Exchange in 1938 and everybody parting. And I felt that was rather appropriate. Unfortunately, it would not scan. And that is her revenge on me. But I will, at some stage, get one onto the parish website. She may well have been the legendary performer, trainer of young voices. She was constantly confiscating lollies at rehearsals. But anecdotal evidence from some of her pupils suggests her sweet tooth ensured the lollies were never returned and consumed privily. She trained generations of singers and instrumentalists. I've met a number, and they said, no, they didn't love her, but they were very glad for her absolutely ruthless training regime, which included leaving her home early in Helena Street and popping in to various pupils' homes to ensure that they were practicing in the correct manner, and giving them a good whack around the shoulders if their posture was not correct. Then she would go to the kitchen and remind the mother of the household that the fees were due. She later became involved in the South Dunedin community arts projects of the 1930s, particularly those run by the Labour government of the day. Though it must be said that the Labour government never succeeded in getting her vote. So, what of all the clubs, organisations that were the manifestation of this movement of communities? Well, believe it or not, from early days, St. Peter's had a Shakespeare Club. The club originated pre-World War I, in the time of Father Evans. They produced a number of plays that focused more on themed excerpts, which by contemporary accounts were well received and well done. Membership in the 1920s peaked at over 60, but the average membership seems to have been about 45. I've met two elderly ladies at Red Bruce who were part of the Shakespeare Club, and they remembered that there were so many members of the club at one stage that for a good 3 years they played trees and associated foliage. They never got a speaking part. But oh, they loved it, and I gather it was extremely well run. Although performances were at St. Peter's Hall, they attracted large audiences from the wider South Dunedin community, but their productions didn't ever move from the hall. This later developed into the well-respected St. Peter's Drama Group, which continued its activities throughout the 1950s and finished around 1961. Although it didn't evolve into the burgeoning little theatre movement, a number of participants went on to work at the newly formed Globe and other theatre groups. Now here's the one I really want to know about. The Glee Club. Little is known about the Glee Club, but it was essentially a fundraising venture. But I know very little about it. I may find more when I get to the Hocken archives. Anecdotal evidence suggests a long-running series of shows and reviews, around two productions a year, in the parish hall from the World War I era onwards. They also joined with other South Dunedin groups to put on larger productions. Their original purpose was to raise funds to pay off the debt on the church building, but this led to a permanent performance group. Bessie Favell trained them and organised orchestras and pianists, but there's little evidence of who directed them or who conducted in the pit. Members later went on to be stalwarts of the emerging light opera and musical scene throughout Dunedin. In the tower room of St. Peter's, in the back of a cupboard, are two very large reels of film. It is said that they are the remnants from the cinema club. I have no idea whether they are, and they are probably decayed beyond playing or even restoration. However, it does show that the cinema club existed, and it existed here. The parish hall was also host to one of Dunning's original cinema or film clubs that blossomed post-World War II. Membership was considerable, though recollections of some suggest a bohemian element tended to run things. It was more an initiative from outside the parish, but was well supported by St. Peter's folk who were brave enough to go and sit on small wooden chairs. Film clubs were sponsored in part by the government and enabled local audiences to experience film styles other than that of the commercial fare offered up by Hollywood and J. Arthur Rank. People came from all around the city to watch the films in a less than comfortable environment. However, the audience developed through the film club led to Dunedin's continued strong film society and various film festivals. I have been told that some first-timers were very disappointed as they sidled into the back row by the very serious and artistic fare on offer. Little of the rather notorious fleshy Scandinavian nature was evidently on offer, and it was noted that they did not make return visits. I've entitled the next part of this presentation, Decline and Fall. But really, I put a question mark after it, because I'm not convinced anymore that that is the case. But the start of the decline of this remarkable and long-standing tradition can be traced to the introduction of television. But perhaps endless, tired reruns of shows such as Chuchin Chow and Naughty Marietta resonated less successfully in the atomic age as they had done in the 20s and 30s. Increasing car ownership meant that families were now not tied to a specific geographic location, nestling the almost tribal affiliation with neighbourhood institutions. But it was a very slow decline. I believe a transition. The huge explosion of popular youth culture in the 1950s and 1960s saw the emergence of different forms of community arts expression. Something the older established forms were very, very, very slow to take on board. Remember these? When they moved it to 8 o'clock, it ended even so. The playmakers we weren't so sure about, but do you remember that the television series with Patrick McGowan and the bouncing ball? Remember that? The Prisoner. And we all stayed at home for all those weeks. I was a very small boy, and my parents were glued to the television. And then at the end of it, they felt very cheated because it went right back to the beginning, all over again. So there was no end. For me, the saddest aspect of this mass movement of popular culture was the slow but sure end of the parish choir. And perhaps surprisingly, given my current interests, the diminished presence on the national and international stage of the Maori show bands. You may wonder what on earth this is doing here. Well, people say, oh, there was no real popular culture in New Zealand until the rock and roll era and so on. Not so. These bands toured internationally and to universal acclaim. Extraordinary professionalism. Rock and roll virtually wiped them out. And it was the first burgeoning, I think, in New Zealand, apart from the poi and tiki culture of Rotorua, the Dean Waratini type thing, this was, for me, the real first burgeoning of a Maori cultural renaissance. extraordinary. I remember vividly as a very small boy being taken to a packed and overflowing Thames Memorial Hall to hear one of the great bands of the time. I no longer remember which one. To be royally entertained in the most extraordinarily professional manner, not seen or heard before. With talents honed on the international circuit, these bands introduced a sophistication into performance that transcended genre. Yet by the mid-1960s, they were slowly fading from view, overtaken by rock music in all its forms. Dunedin has had a part in this. The rise of what's been called the Dunedin sound developed a culture all of its own. It marked out Dunedin as different, something that doesn't happen all that often these days. And it led to an extraordinary music initiative at the music department of the university. Young people now come from all over New Zealand and from overseas, not only to learn piano, voice and other instruments, as we know, to the highest level, something we're all very proud of, but also many come to take part in the rock and contemporary music program. This is a sophisticated response to those historic popular cultural explosions and bodes well for the future of performance, even though my older ears do not always sufficiently appreciate the results. So, what of the future? So much of the history of music making in South Dunedin revolved around the various churches. It is an extraordinary cultural history, too little acknowledged. In a recent interview, Dunedin musicologist Dr. Jenny Birchall spoke of a lack of really good musical histories of Dunedin artistic life. And I hope her sterling work in researching the history of the City Choir Dunedin is just the beginning. However, in thinking of her work, it is intriguing to note that so much of the secular artistic expression in Dunedin has been historically based around church theatre groups, parish choirs, cinema clubs, drama groups, and the like. In the 21st century, it is no longer the case. Rather than lament this loss, though I do from time to time, because it really is a matter of contemporary cultural impoverishment, I am of the mind these days that there is a creative challenge to communities such as St. Peter's. St. Peter's can and does regularly provide a comfortable and artistically satisfying venue for performances of all kinds. We have a superb plant here for both rehearsal and performance. The youth choral scheme, initiated some years ago by the remarkable Harold Goodall in the UK, has seen a veritable explosion of school and civic youth choirs. That movement, like the creative movement of earlier days, has gone global. It is now cool to sing and be in choirs. In New Zealand, there would not be a school, large or small, without a good choir or choirs. In tandem with this movement, the 20th century cultural renaissance within Māoridom has seen the spread throughout this community of kapahaka groups and a whole new, but old, performance tradition. The many ethnic groups from Pacifica to a multiplicity of performance troupes from Europe and Asia suggest a rich tapestry of artistic expression, even more varied than before. A recent street festival here in South Dunedin was filled with sounds of young people and their performances. It was remarkable to witness the levels of accomplishment and sheer enthusiasm of all those taking part. On a larger scale, the enormous interest in events such as the Big Sing fills the town stage with youthful performers bodes well, I believe, for the future. It's a different future. It is challenging, but not necessarily solely church-based anymore, but built on a long tradition where that was so. I have always thought that St. Peter's, for example, with its side aisles and interesting variety of floor levels, could well play host to dramatic presentations such as Murder in the Cathedral. or one of the medieval morality plays that are now appearing in modern editions, that even illiterates like me can understand. It is with initiative, innovation, and enthusiastic inclusion that artistic expression can again come back to parishes such as this, though in St. Peter's case, it never really went away. As I embark on a research project that is not as yet particularly formulated, it interests me greatly to find out whether other churches in South Dunedin have had the same experience over the years as St. Peter's. How did it feed into the day-to-day life of the community here? And how did it enrich and enliven many of those taking part have long gone, and much of the material is archived at the Hocken Library or at the Hewitson Library at Knox College. Memories and details are also still available through faded copies of centenary booklets, old programs, pamphlets and newspaper cuttings. This is an old-fashioned research methodology, yet one that should fit the aims of the project well, and give this old musical ham something to do in the wee small hours of a late career. I look forward to presenting what I find to you sometime in the future, with the proviso in the sighing words of the old Scots lady, if I'm spared. Thank you. You may ask questions. I have no idea who they are. They're just randomly taken off the internet. If you go onto YouTube and find him, it's remarkable. These little hands just playing, and I thought, he'll make a mistake. I know this piece. Not at all. But also, a few years ago, you would have never had large groups of young people, teenagers and so on, singing in public. I put this down partly to the influence of the Goodall program in the UK, which is quite phenomenal. It has international competitions now, focused particularly on the Queen's Hall in London and various other places around the UK. Draw thousands and thousands of young people. And what I'm intrigued about is, what do they do when they leave the program? And the same kind of program works here. I mean, any of you have heard the choral groups at St. Hilda's, Otago Boys, Kings and Queens, all the rest of it, and extremely enthusiastic young ones down here in the school down here, McAndrew Intermediate, whatever it's called. I'm sure it's got a new name. Remarkable. Whereas a few years ago, they would have been struggling for membership. And it seems to be only increasing and increasing. And you can see it in the remarkable standards of the city choir and the various other choirs around New Zealand. And inevitably, it may well be that places like St. Peter's don't produce the shows and the singers anymore, but they enable the expression of those singers and performers in providing the venues, programs, and so on. I believe it will have, in time, a cross-pollinating effect. It's quite often that over many years as a church organist, I have been asked by university lecturers and so on, particularly from music departments, please can you get my students to come and sing in a liturgical situation, because they may well know about the Mozart Requiem and they may sing it beautifully, but they have no idea where it really ought to be performed. And they see it only as a concert work. And after a performance of a work such as that, the students come up to the conductor and say, I never knew there were different ways of doing this great work. So I think that there is an extraordinary future for music making. We will benefit from it one way or another if we're open to saying St. Peter's welcomes all who God sends. I think what really needs to be the motto in this case. Which wasn't actually an answer to a question, but I felt like saying it anyway.
I was still the question, sir. You mentioned the event of television and the effect out of the community and the diminishing because you sat and didn't partake of anything. Would it be, in your opinion, the advent of television has caused rejuvenation insofar as we have talent? Yes. Hey, we want to get involved and am I pushing the envelope too far?
There is an argument to say that the modern phenomena of reality television and talent shows definitely has shown that you can give up there and structure stuff, but it was happening already. I think the fact that these talent shows exist at all is the result of this community movement of music making that I thought was dying on its feet. You know, I was involved in the Waikato with community arts programs and all the rest of it. We struggled, A, to get funding or B, to particularly get interest. Now, it's the other way around, completely the other way around. So one doesn't despair in terms of the arts. One just needs to live long enough to see it and reinvent itself, I think. The television, certainly, it changed. You didn't go out to be entertained. You didn't require the need anymore to entertain yourselves. It was all there for you. Now, that's different. Most of my students wouldn't dream of looking at television. It's just so uncool. It's so easy. They download streaming television. They might watch television at some time that's convenient to them if they watch it at all. They download streaming films, often before they have appeared in the New Zealand cinemas. The interesting thing also is the return of radio. I don't know whether this is a short-lived thing or what, but with the age of the personal music centre that you carry around with you from your phone and so on, you can also locate radio stations from all around the world. And I would say 60% of my students, and these are media savvy students in the film media department, take most of their news from radio broadcasts, which they'll follow up on a blog site or a news site on the internet. And the amazing thing for me was to find that well over half of my third year students got their news in the morning from Morning Report on national radio, which I would have thought would be far too crusty for them. However, Morning Report, Radio New Zealand National, have done a remarkable thing. They've set up a website purely and simply for young people, and it's called The Wireless. And they mightn't know the term in the same way as we would know wireless, but it's getting a huge number of hits, very, very successful. And it's aimed at them, purely and simply, and it's building a new market for the state broadcasting.
And what about the rise and fall of local record shops, which where somebody who really loved what they were doing in terms of selling that music could act as mentors in terms of popular music to young people, and where people gathered together to listen to that and to exchange views, and how that's going?
Jeremy Elwood on Jim Moore's programme on national radio this afternoon was talking about the same thing in terms of video shops. The great international video hire chain, Blockbuster, closed today, internationally. And he was talking about the fact that it's not the same just going in and anonymously downloading something. It's wonderful to go in have a relationship with the video geek or whatever behind the counter so that you can say, what do you think of this? Well, I saw it last week, I didn't think it was all that marvellous, that sort of thing. Or maybe suggest to you that the foreign language film is really well subtitled. You ought to go and have a look at this because it's better than the Hollywood version. Yes, there is that. However, I think it's more the medium has changed. And for example, for films, I can only go on my own students. If they want to know about music, they go on their favourite music review blog and find out what other people, perhaps of their own generation, are saying, and then they might think about downloading it. But it's part of this movement that privileges the individual. But we don't really live in an age of community necessarily, which makes these manifestations so unusual in many ways, because you would expect it to be more individual effort and triumph. But in fact, I think it is the way of purveying music that's different. I'm of the generation, put it this way, I look at the generation, I like a CD, to open it, to read the book, all the rest of it. But that is now considered old technology. And I suspect in the future you will simply download what you want to listen to for the week. But you'll go beforehand to things like the Gramophone Online or something like that to find the reviews, to find out what other people say. I suspect that cyberspace and bloggers such as those have taken the place of the person at the music shop. I suspect it's not the same. I miss it.